Afterward. Some Dark Holler by Jack Womack. The first time I ever heard of William Gibson was 1,000 years ago, in 1987. While waiting for my first novel to come out, I started keeping a close eye on the competition. Not that I knew who the competition might be, for I was totally at sea when it came to science fiction. The alien life I found on this planet was quite enough for me, then and now. In the Village Voice, there appeared a rave review of Count Zero. From the reviewer's comments, I inferred that the author's earlier book had caused something of a stir. The article worried me, for it made me think that this Gibson fellow had already marked all the fire hydrants on the block while I was still begging to be let out of the yard. Conveniently enough, for research purposes, I worked in a bookstore at the time, and although the owner was extremely snooty when it came to selling literature as opposed to literature, there was a copy of Count Zero in stock. I read it. Soon enough, I realized that although William Gibson and I were kicking the same groin, we were shod in variant footwear. I very much admired and envied his. I relaxed. Turning to the back flap, I examined the author photo. An affable fellow, I instinctively thought. He appeared not at all auctorial in the insufferable sense of the word. I think of writers who pose with their dogs, or hold questionable medical devices, or mousse their hair until its specific gravity resembles that of a pound cake. Gibson looked vaguely sheepish, even a tad damp, as if it had begun to rain while the picture was being taken, and the photographer warned him in no uncertain terms not to move. I could identify. By the time his next dust jacket photo was taken, from Mona Lisa Overdrive, Gibson had had the opportunity to become the fashion plate he is today. Suave, stylish, wafer-thin, button-cute, and as moisture-proof as a 1947 Swedish Air Force wristwatch. Post-cyberpunk, that is to say, although no one did at the time, for the surface world of the C-word was still, seemingly, in medias res. Meanwhile, however, in the valleys south of San Francisco and east of Seattle, a truer and far more lasting C-word was heaving itself into fast-developing existence. The sky above the port was the color of television, tuned to a dead channel. Great novels start with great opening lines, and the opening line of Neuromancer is hard to beat. Although dead television channels now transmit a different color than they did when Gibson typed, on a typewriter, bear in mind, these words, the color of that predicted sky is, if not the precise shade, that of a hue that falls within the same tonal range as the one hanging over us today. When I look back with the benefit of years at what happened when Neuromancer came out, speaking as one who wasn't actually there at the time, I can only compare the effect its appearance must have had on science fiction readers to the effect Dylan had on his listeners when he decided to go electric. Gibson laid the groundwork with his marvelous short stories several years earlier, the Gernsback syndrome being my personal favorite, but I've always been a deco hound. Yet this was something else. Full Tilt Gibson shoots its Tesla-strength voltage not merely through the head, but down along the spine, spinning each chakra on its axis in sequence. The difference between the stories and the novels is the difference between coffee and methadrin. Neuromancer, critically praised in most every quarter, won 3 of the field's major awards. Even so, not since the days of the New Wave in the 60s had there been such consternation over and misinterpretation of a book and its significance among those who should know better, but somehow never do. Looking back, we can see that it wasn't so much Gibson himself or Neuromancer itself that so painfully prodded the fat asses, in both senses of the term, most in need of prodding, but rather the attendant commentary from certain of Gibson's more, intense supporters. Bruce Sterling, winking like mad the whole time, clearly intended his manifestos and diatribes to be somewhat over the top in order to achieve the highest possible level of annoyance, along with maxima gruvitudina. But others, including many who'd never gone near a science fiction novel before in their lives, nor should they have, took what came, quickly, to be called cyberpunk, far more seriously than they should have. Nasty remarks pelted like rain on the hard, bony heads of the more oafish supporters and detractors alike, but there was no inconsiderable fun in that. Everyone loves a fight when no one loves the fighters. The speedy commodification of cyberpunk, trademark, within and beyond the genre, however, was what peeved far many more, notably Gibson, who remembers seeing cyberpunk trousers advertised in a store window during his first trip to Japan a decade ago. Countless incompetents and ghastly old hacks, keen to cash in on the main chance, wasted no time churning out hot jack-in product, ephemeral as toilet tissue, memorable as a restaurant flyer. A number of innocents and miscreants gainfully employed in other métiers were inspired as well, God help them, to produce creative work of similar worth in the spirit of the subgenre they perceived to exist. But let us draw a merciful curtain over such dopey homages as Billy Idol's album Cyberpunk. Bet you'd forgotten that one, yes? There was no way the beast could survive such wounds, especially once the marketing boys circled round for the kill, and the true end of cyberpunk came so suddenly that no one noticed it missing until several years after it was gone. Still, as romantics continued to cite what they believed to be passenger pigeons as late as the 1930s, there are still occasional amateur sightings of something kind of resembling it. Cyberpunk qua cyberpunk served, in the long run, only to provide a facile adjective for the working vocabulary of lazy journalists and unimaginative blurb writers. Yet even those at least partially in the know about science fiction, if nothing more, who debated, defended, or denigrated Gibson, didn't have the faintest idea of what Gibson was actually doing. Though he didn't either, at least not at the time. No writer knows what he or she has actually created until the book is actually read by others. Neuromancer, foremost, was a shout in the night that was the 1980s, is the 1990s, and will be, it seems to me, the decades soon to come. That is to say, a foreshadowing and estimation of our future, derived from a specific reinterpretation of our present, and in this very special instance lifted into actuality through the agency of its readers. For if Gibson in truth had nothing to do with the making of cyberpunk, as it came to be known, he didn't create it, didn't name it, and after it was cursed with its catchy moniker, didn't want a whole lot to do with it, in the most genuine sense, he did create cyberspace. Not merely the word, C-V-O-E-D, the place. Cyberspace, a consensual hallucination experienced daily by billions of legitimate operators in every nation. In every generation, there's room enough in the American popular mind to admit only one science fiction writer. It was Bradbury for a while, and then Asimov, and then that guy who writes Star Trek Wars. Gibson transcended that role almost at once. In attaining a cultural summit of another order, one that I believe history will demonstrate to be of considerably higher altitude, he outmaneuvered this cultural narrowcasting in a way that might possibly have been imagined but never predicted by anyone, certainly not in print, and surely not by science fiction writers. Let me emphasize a point earlier glanced upon. All fiction, whether straight or genre, whether literature or literature, is a personal reinterpretation of its writer's existence during the time the fiction was written. Therefore, science fiction has rarely predicted with any accuracy, save through coincidence or extremely well-informed suppositions a la Verne or Wells, the specifics of the future that ensues post-publication. Where do you park your atomic-powered lawnmower? Sometimes, however, who can say how the spark catches fire, how the fish manages to live on land, it turns out to exactly, mysteriously, capture the spirit. In Neuromancer, Gibson first apprehended, as no one else had, what I believe shall prove to be the shape of things to come. He saw the writing on the wall, the blood in the sky, the warning in the entrails, saw the mind beneath the mirror shades, as it were, and what that mind would be capable or incapable of thinking. Saw the substance disguised in style. What if someone in the spring of 1914 had stood in the center of Berlin, foresaw in a vision the philosophies and worldviews capable of provoking the events for which the 20th century would be most remembered, and then went off and wrote it all down. Now, let's be Heisenbergian and ask, what if the act of writing it down, in fact, brought it about? When Neuromancer appeared, it was picked up and devoured by hundreds, then thousands, of men and women who worked in or around the garages and cubicles where what is still called new media were fitfully being birthed. Thousands who, on reading his sentence as quoted above, thought to themselves, "That's so fucking cool," and set about searching for any way the gold of imagination might be transmuted into silicon reality. Now, Gibson's imagined future cannot by any means be called optimistic, nor in truth can it be called pessimistic. It is beyond both. More to the point, he has often said that he intended cyberspace to be nothing more than a metaphor. No matter. Once a creation goes out in the world, its creator, like any parent, loses the control once so easily exertible over the offspring. Another variety of emergent behavior, you could say. "That's so fucking cool, man! I think we can pull it off!" So, rather than the theoretical matrix, we now, thanks to all those beautiful William Gibson readers out there in the dark, have the actual web. Same difference, for all intents and purposes, or it will be soon enough. And it seems to me that had he not sat at his typewriter in 1983 and written that sentence, and the book in which it is found, our present condition, cyber condition, if you must, would be considerably different than it would have otherwise been. William Gibson did something that every writer hopes to do, and very, very rarely does. Change the world. Whether for better or worse, Microsoft or something similar will tell, but that in no way lessens the awe you should feel, seeing the elephant. Charles Fort, another American treasure, wrote, "A social growth cannot find out the use of steam engines until comes steam engine time." As steam engines go, Neuromancer turns out to be the 21st century limited, and all of us find ourselves on board. A couple of years passed before Bill Gibson and I first met. Prior to that time, we'd spoken on the phone, he'd written a fine blurb for my second novel, sent me my own copies of Count Zero and Mona Lisa, and proffered a comment about my work and its ambience during an interview he had with Spin Magazine, which my publisher's publicists fed on for years. He is better than anyone else I know of at coming up with the pithy and infinitely reusable remark, the quotable phrase, the perfect literary soundbite. I've been attempting to learn from his example for years. In other words, without trying, we were making favorable impressions on one another from the start. When we did at last meet, it was in 1991, at a party here in New York for The Difference Engine. Most of the usual local suspects were present, zeroing in on the action, and so whenever possible we hied ourselves to more secure parts of the room, the better to escape the purveyors of Phonus Bolonus. He gave me a copy of Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian, and I told him about that day's big news in New York, the finding of a box of frozen human heads down on Avenue A, said box having apparently tumbled off a truck en route to the cryogenics clinic. Suffice to say, we were as impressed with one another in person, in our own inimitable ways, as we had been at a distance. He and I knew from the start that we had much in common, little of which involved science fiction. At the instant each of us first heard the other speak, and detected in our voices a familiar tonality, we realized we were members of the same tribe. Although Bill had been living in British Columbia, Canada, for well over 20 years, and that year in New York was my 12th, we had both started out as boys of the mountains and valleys, the hills and the hollers, as folks still say, down there. We'd grown up on either side of the sclerotic spine of the eastern mountains, he in Virginia, not far into the post-war era, and me in Kentucky, 8 years after that. The importance of his beginnings to what Gibson has written and continues to write may perhaps be hard to grasp for those who imagine that past and future, like oil and water, are discrete entities, but its magnitude cannot and must not be ignored. Cyberspace is infinite, but starts with each person who chooses to step into it, and I speak now of he who in the first place dreamed it into life. Cyberspace was born where the laurel grows lush and verdant, where the dogwoods blossom and the whippoorwills cry in the wind-whipped limbs of the tulip trees. It was born between the ridges, deep in the glades, where streams rush cold along their limestone courses, born high on the mountainsides not yet strip-mined for their coal, atop the lone green knobs of Mars. The Southern Highlands, this region was once called, we now call it Appalachia. This part of the United States has been since the Revolution, and even now to some degree remains, not merely rural, but distant, in time as well as place. Its light filters down through the branches from another world's sun. Bill Gibson remembered that world, however often or for whatever reasons he might try to forget it. He remembered the raw-boned old men with faces lined like dry riverbeds, sun-bleached fedoras on their heads and white shirts beneath their overalls as they hoed the fields. Remembered the five-and-dime store with wooden floors worn glass smooth and countertops lined with trays top-full with marbles, notions, and gimcrackery. He recalled the sound of a fired gun echoing off the hill on the far side of an autumnal field and the mysterious way a shard of grandparental history excavated during some slow summer afternoon, whether in the basement's icebox or the attic's bake oven, could possess such limitless fascination. He still understood the nature of the private commentary of men, cognizant of the sort of words and kind of phrasing barbershop regulars stopped using the moment a stranger or mother stepped through the door. He still saw the stare in the eyes of old women who might have been recalling the day their husbands headed east to the Western Front, or the look on their fathers' faces when they heard that a friend wouldn't be coming back from the hole. He still tapped a foot to radio ballads as they poured ethereally from a barn dance or fiddle festival two states away, marking the rhythm in the same manner as did the community elders, although unlike him, the ancients remembered a day when everything they heard would be heard solely in the instant it was produced, never again, and leaving no more lasting trace than snowflakes falling onto the tongue. And he could still listen to the far-off plaint of a train horn as the express rolled through the night, wailing through a darkness lit solely by moon and fireflies, a sound that planted in his mind the awareness that one day he too would travel far away from that country of heart and home, would necessarily flee, as if pursued by hounds, a world that essentialed abrogation as it demanded honorific, a sound endlessly entrancing, yet infinitely sad, the unignorable siren call of the wider world without. The wider world waited, and he would go there. I remember these things too, and this is how I know where cyberspace was born. The proximity of our beginnings has proven to be one of our deepest bonds. Only in the past couple of years have we realized to what degree we remember the country that gave form to our souls, and how that remembrance informs every thought we think, every word we write. It is starting to sink in that with the passing of each hour now, as we leave one century and step into another, that place, that past, becomes ever more lost inside the shadows with which time enshrouds its mummy. Gibson has called it the world before television, a talent for the perfect phrase, as said. The past lingers in unexpected and unavoidable ways long after we believe it gone. Six of one, half a dozen of the other, as they say. Our cultural and historical past is readily accessible to everyone today, so long as you choose to turn it on or download it. Today, as never before, the information media having become to enlightenment as the cereal aisle is to the supermarket, if you choose not to access the past, you are de facto free to rule it out of existence, at least so far as you might be concerned. But the personal past, while deniable if need be for a while, is far more difficult to tune out, As in a Soviet hotel room, the radio is impossible to turn all the way off. Gibson's characters, I call them us, know this to be the case as often as you do. Read his books and reread them, and see anew how many references you find therein to events or incidents that occurred at some unspecified time before the narrative begins, and to nostalgic reveries of that which is no longer the way it was. How often his characters grow dimly aware of vague regrets for which they have no name, as if they are haunted unto their deathbeds with not only their own memories, but with someone else's memories as well. Realize as you read to what degree and to what effect Gibson employs the images of evocative clutter and disarray to create a setting against which, as in an individual life, stray pieces of past days linger long enough to meld through coeval existence into an aspect, the major aspect, in many ways, of the contemporary world in which they remain. I'm not referring to the overwhelming post-apocalyptic damage and decay so often used in the set design of contemporary films when their directors attempt to depict a futuristic environment, these visuals usually being variants of those created for Blade Runner and The Road Warrior, and Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange, first of all, although such images have been omnipresent in near-future fiction as well. No, I speak instead of the scattered objects glimpsed within Chiba City bars and market stalls, or most especially in Skinner's room, in virtual light, each token of mundane temporality made rare by the passage of time, each described by Gibson with watchmaker's precision and unconditional love. The black-and-white family photographs in their crumbling albums, the outmoded toaster ovens, the mildewed paperbacks, the scratched LPs, which today go unsold at yard sales or gather dust in thrift stores, but which tomorrow will prove to be pearls beyond price. The box of stuff in the back of the closet, detritus that accumulates in the desk's bottom drawers, the lint in the navel of a private civilization, hinting at an apocalypse that, if apocalypse at all, could have been nothing other than personal. When the past is always with you, it may as well be present, and if it is present, it will be future as well. Surely it is the constant awareness of that faraway past, in which he lived intensely, if not always happily, that so crystallizes Bill Gibson's sense of what the future will hold, and what will be most sorely missed there. A couple of years ago, I was sealed up for a month in one of the hospitals here in New York with multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis, the cyberpunk variety, it would be fair, if painful, to say. Although Bill, like me, had always been pretty iffy about the general atmosphere that clings to hospitals, he nonetheless came to visit me. I suspect I piqued his interest by alerting him to the fact that my isolation unit rather resembled the ultimate Philippe Stark hotel room. He passed through the double doors and strapped on a mask, and there sat at my bedside while we spoke of the evasive ways of doctors, admired the perfect dread inherent to the design of the biohazard symbol, watched the sun setting over New Jersey, and I tried not to cough. His visit meant a lot to me. The nature of friendship is such that you never know who will turn out to be your friends, but once you have met them, you can't imagine that you could have gone through life without ever knowing them. Bill and I have been through our own difficult moments in our respective lives, and while I hope I've always been there for him, there's no question that he's always been there for me. Doubtless, I am not the only person who can say this. I think anyone who knows him knows that there is no better nor more generous person, both as a writer and as a friend, than Bill Gibson. His creative intelligence is wicked, but his soul is pure. A few months after I was released, Harry Smith's Anthology of American Folk Music was re-released in our present-day country on CD. Every young person needs one, Luc Sant said at the time, and I agree, especially everyone who comes from that part of the country where so much of the music was originally recorded, up in the hills and down in the hollers. As soon as I was able, I bought Bill a set and sent it off to him, where he tells me he has spent considerable time driving through Vancouver nights, often with his son, listening repeatedly to a soundtrack that might seem, but isn't, utterly at odds with his or anyone's landscape today, 70-odd years after the fact. After he had the opportunity to listen to the discs at length, we talked, among much else, about the particular songs that made the deepest impression on us, and the particular artists who contained in their electronically preserved voices those sounds most evocative of what has been lost, and how it is possible to take from them all that can be recovered in order to be, partially, truly, reborn. I think every writer would wish to evoke in 1,000 words what can be evoked in a single line of music. There were a number of textural variants of the song East Virginia Blues, recorded during the great period of 1927 to 1932. The version on the anthology is Buell Cassy's, and it is a good one, although my personal favorite is Clarence Ashley's. One line of the song, which is often found interpolated into other songs by other artists, sears into my heart each time I hear it, no matter who the singer might be. Bill has quoted it himself, I believe. It is one of the lines I'd give a million words to have written. I'd rather be in some dark holler where the sun don't never shine. The sensibility that underlay American science fiction for many years was one of purest optimism, an unquestioning faith that no matter how dire things were at any one moment, or how impossible seemed the troubles remaining to be made right, as long as a heaping helping of reason and loads of gung-ho inventiveness were put to good use, everything that was not as it should be would be sorted out, and life unimaginably improved. This sensibility, as we all know, makes up as well the largest part of what still passes as the archetypal American spirit, for better or worse. Although such blind optimism lingers in that species of science fiction that today enjoys the largest sales, reason has nothing to do with it, and gung-ho inventiveness is most often employed to market test the potential salability of collectible tie-in merchandise. Their critical success notwithstanding, the fact that Bill's books have enjoyed such commercial success in the face of Star Wars, Star Trek, triple-decker fantasy, and any number of shoot-'em-up video and computer games testifies to their undeniable power. In the parallel world, there may be a Molly action figure, complete with spring-out fingernails, but don't wait for one to turn up on eBay here. Plainly, his readers recognize, if but subcutaneously, that there's quite a lot more in a William Gibson book than great characters and a good story. To be truly ready to confront the future, actual or imagined, societal or personal, and to live reasonably within it once you are ready, an entente cordiale must first be made with the past, and the past is always the more frightening of the two. Traveling from past to future means looking and leaping, stepping blindly into the void, passing through the darkest of hollers. Sometimes the leap needed seems too far, the void too empty, the holler too oddly reassuring in its darkness. But there is no avoiding it. Hope that you'll emerge on the far side with minimal trauma. Have faith, pray, wish as you will, but as science fiction writers know so well, there's no predicting what will be. Clichés became clichés for a reason, that they usually hold at least a modicum of truth, and the following cliché is truer than most. You can't know where you're going if you don't know where you've been. That goes for readers as well as writers. In transversing the passage through his own dark holler, William Gibson learned, as all writers who matter learn, to emit one of quite a different nature. A warning shout, yes, but an exclamation of wonder as well. One that will echo across more landscapes than we can imagine for many years. It seems to me that in these interesting times of ours, in the maelstrom of POMO distractions, not only have attention spans shortened, but so as well have memories. I have no way of knowing what today's young people will recall years hence when they remember the world before cyberspace. I am positive, however, that they'll not forget Bill Gibson. My colleague, my friend, my brother, in the middle of your great career, I salute you. This is Robertson Dean. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Neuromancer by William Gibson. This program was executive produced by Patty Perus and produced by Janet Stark. Neuromancer is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc., and Books on Tape.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.